Hello, this is The Game Podcast from The Times, and I'm Natalie Sawyer. Joining Gregor Robertson and I today, it is James Restall. James, long time no speak. Pleasure to have you with us. How are you?
I'm very, very good, thank you. Absolute pleasure to be here, albeit from the spare bedroom in my mother-in-law's house.
Oh, how intriguing. Would you like to paint that picture for us of the spare bedroom?
I can. It's it has an all-round wraparound hand-painted Disney motif. So I'm currently looking at Captain Hook. It has been one of the better Zoom lockdown backgrounds, I must say.
I love it. I love that picture that we've now been painted. That is fabulous. Gregor, how are you doing?
I'm good. I don't have anything like those surroundings, I'm afraid. Just looking at my cat sleeping on the spare room bed in my spare room.
Oh, look at you all having spare rooms. Fabulous. Here on the pod, it is an EFL special. So stand by for more on Wigan, Wickham, West Brom, and yes, of course, you've guessed it, Brent.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now, Brentford moved to just a point behind second place West Brom last night in the Championship table after a narrow 1-0 win over Preston North End at Griffin Park. It was that man again, Ollie Watkins, who made the difference as his early goal settled the tie, meaning the forward has now scored 25 goals in 44 Championship appearances this season. It means with two games to play, Brentford have 81 points, with West Brom in second on 82. The remaining games see Brentford play relegation-threatened Stoke away and Barnsley at home, whereas West Brom travel to Huddersfield before QPR at home. So, Gregor, this is an intriguing fight, and obviously I will sit on the fence for this one. who is your money on to grab second place?
I think we will know this weekend. I think Huddersfield are obviously fighting for their lives, so that's a real challenge for West Brom. And the same with Stoke and you guys playing this weekend. So, you know, the last two games, Barnsley and QPR, I think they're almost gimmies. So I think we could know this weekend. And the run Brentford have been on is just remarkable. And it's always felt like this. It was almost a matter of time before things really clicked and Brentford went on a run like this and came within this kind of touching distance of the Premier League. So that, I'm sitting on the fence here, but I think it's really tough. I think West Brom, unfortunately, in that might just see it over the line. But I think, as I say, this is the real test for them this weekend. After that, I think we'll know.
Sorry. I didn't want to hear that, but you know, that's fair enough. That is fair enough. They have the advantage, obviously, as things stand. But just before we talk more in detail about Brentford, which I'm going to enjoy, when you look at the West Brom situation, they started the restart not in the best of form. They didn't win their first two games, but now actually they're unbeaten in their last five, albeit they've drawn their last two games, 1-1 with Blackburn, and then it was a goalless bore against Fulham. I wanted to ask you, James, I've been listening into what Slaven Bilic has had to say of West Brom of late, and he's spoken about how it's been a very nervous end to this Championship season. He's spoken about how they've got two extremely difficult games, not only because of the opponent, definitely with that, but also because of the pressure. if you're hearing a manager speak like that, does that put some doubt into him and into West Brom in a way and how they're approaching all of this?
It's a bit frightening, isn't it? I was talking to Tom Roddy, who was covering the game for us just before the podcast, and he said he covers a lot of Wolves, Tom, and he says that Nuno can be quite infuriating because he's very guarded. He never really speaks his mind. He always keeps his cards quite close to his chest. But as a player, I'd be interested to know what you think about this, Gregor, incidentally. You know, as a player, you must, that's great. You know, the manager's not giving anything away, and kind of that must breed some kind of confidence. If I was in the West Brom dressing room, I'd be thinking, don't tell everyone that we're all nervous and anxious, because it creates this whole this negativity, and particularly when you've got Brentford, who are going like an absolute train, and you know, one result maybe earlier in the season, have one result gone differently, they'd be in the driving seat now. I don't really get his strategy. I obviously, we like managers to be open and to be honest, but at the same time, I think Slaven's possibly sort of been a bit guilty here of saying too much.
Gregor, what do you think?
I get that, yeah. I mean, I think that actually, you know, no matter what he says, it's all pretty clear at this point. You know, there's two games and they've got a point lead. You know, the time for any kind of mind games is over. I think, you know, it all depends on his approach as well. I'm absolutely certain that, you know, in training through the week, he's trying to lighten the mood and ease the pressure. But he's just being very honest in front of the cameras, and I'm sure he's being honest to the players too. And they know that themselves. They know that they've let a big lead slip, and really there's no more room for error. So they have to. The pressure is on, and it's how they deal with that now.
You'd still rather be in their position, wouldn't you? You'd still rather have the points on the board, and that's the, you know, you speak to players who've been in that situation, and they'll always tell you that it's far better to be in the position with points on the board and knowing that it's in your hands.
Well, as it is, Gregor, you said that you think West Brom are going to get there and get over the line eventually. But let's focus on Brentford and whether or not that front three can give them the edge. Watkins' strike last night now means Brentford's front three of Watkins, Benrahma and Brian Mbeumo have scored 57 goals between them this season, as many as the whole Preston squad had managed in the league. 24-year-old Watkins had been a winger until the start of this season, where he was converted into a central role to replace last year's top scorer Neil Mopay, who joined Brighton in a £20 million deal. It's been a fantastic transformation for Watkins this season, Gregor. How much credit does he deserve? And also the head coach, Thomas Frank.
Yeah, I think both enormous credit. I mean, as you say, he wasn't a centre forward until the beginning of the season, and it was a move that Frank kind of laid out to him in the summer and said, you know, Mopay moved on to Brighton. He believed he could play centre forward, and but there was always going to be a question mark about that. You know, he has all the attributes to be a very modern kind of forward in a front three, especially from wide. He's good at coming in and you know, coming off the line, excellent carrying the ball, but he's shown the kind of that kind of killer instinct in and around the 6-yard box as well. There's been a lot of goals where he's just been Johnny on the spot, and that's not really something that you can be coached to this extent. You know, it's an amazing goals haul, and yeah. So Thomas Frank has been, you know, he's someone I won't disguise the fact I was slightly kind of suspicious about whether he was going to be a success when he was handed the reins. I think they lost kind of 7 in a row or something. That you'll know that better than me. You know, it wasn't a good start for him at all. But it's just, you know, as I say, that every time you question Brentford or you question the model, or, you know, there's been so much said about the way that they run the club and, you know, the whole Moneyball narrative, any time you question it, they answer those questions after time, over a little bit of time. And, you know, I remember I wrote a piece about Brentford when they played Leicester in the Cup, and I was essentially saying the same thing. It's, you know, we keep saying the same thing about Brentford. The narrative and the model hasn't changed, so it does feel like a matter of time. Even if they don't go up automatically, they are the team to beat in the playoffs. And if even if they don't go up this season, you know, we'd say to ourselves, they probably have to sell someone like Watkins. Benrahma is being looked at by a lot of big clubs in England now. But they just signed Brian Mbeumo for, you know, he's 20 years old. And he's been outstanding. They signed Tarek Fosu in January from Oxford. He's another player who can step up. And you look at the track record of their recruitment, and there's more, you know, there's so many players you could pick out. That's why I'm saying it's a matter of time. This does feel like the best shape they've ever been in, but it feels like a matter of time.
Oh, Gregor, what are you doing to me? let's focus a little bit more, James, on Ollie Watkins now. He is the league's outright top scorer. He's had a terrific season. Gregor's sort of mentioned his attributes, how his link-up play with our forward options is fantastic. He's confident on the ball. He's confident with his skills. He works so tirelessly as well, how he presses and helps to defend. He's simply been outstanding. Is he someone that you can imagine with all the stats that he's a candidate for player of the season?
Undoubtedly so. What's so remarkable is not just the transition from winger to forward. It's the way he's actually developed his game as a striker. He's in the last two seasons, he scored one goal with his left foot. He scored seven with his left this season. If you split his goals down, you've got seven with his left, nine with his right, eight with his head. I mean, that to me is the definition of an all-round forward. Someone who could, when Harry Kane took the next step at Tottenham, he went from being a predominantly right-footed player to someone who was scoring more headers and more left-footed goals. And it's being able to be in the right place at the right time and have that instinct to get into position that you know that when the ball comes in, you will score and you will back yourself with whatever body part. He's also got one goal with which Opta confusingly say other. So we can guess what body part that was. I don't know. But he's scoring goals in all manner of ways. The other thing as well is, and this is you know, don't shoot me for making what might seem a bit of a ludicrous comparison, but when one thing with Cristiano Ronaldo is he runs far less with the ball and has kind of and now just moves into good positions to receive the ball to score. And as Watkins has transitioned from kind of a more traditional wide player to a centre forward, two seasons ago, he was completing on average about three dribbles per match. He's averaging less than one dribble per match this season. He's backing himself to be in the right positions rather than to do things with the ball at his feet. And I think that is the sign of why he could potentially get even better, because he's not just learnt this role, but he's learnt how to develop his game within this role.
Fascinating. That was really interesting. But I would say that as a Brentford fan. But I mean, but from what I'm led to believe, you know, he works hard at training as well. He's sort of one of those that is out on the training ground till the very end. And if he sees the B team training, he'll go and train with them. If they're doing some sort of striking training, if that is what's happening out on the pitch. So, you know, he's working hard and it's obviously paying dividends by what you're just telling us, James, with all those stats. But obviously he is part of that front three, the BMW, as they're known at Brentford. And Gregor, you know about them, you've seen them. Just how clinical are they? Do you think they are the most clinical in the league?
Oh yeah, by a long shot. I mean, Benrahma as well. He'd actually seemed to have dipped a little bit from his form last season in terms of goals and assists, and then particularly since restart, he's just been electric. Some of the skills and as I say, Mbeumo. You know, even when Mbeumo, I was at the first game against Fulham. And Mbeumo, you know, that was the kind of big news before kickoff that he contracted coronavirus, and you're thinking, my goodness. And then Tarek Fosu came in, he was outstanding, and they found and Benrahma scored one goal and set up another for Marcondes. So, you know, they just find a way to win. But actually, you know, we're talking about the front line. What really has got them in this position this year is the defence, because they've always scored goals. I think last season they conceded 59 goals, and this season they've conceded 35. And Leeds are the only team who's conceded fewer. And that's only by one, so 34. So that's really has been the difference. And you know, as electric as that front three is, Pontus Janssen's arrival, Ethan Pinnock at the back has been outstanding. Rico Henry's managed to stay fit at left back. There's more balance about it, and it was again when I spoke to Thomas Frank just before that game against Leicester, he said that that was a thing that they began to approach a year ago, and it was a concerted effort. They realised that, you know, they can play all this kind of free flowing football and be really easy on the eye and score so many goals, but the thing that made them finish mid table last season was the fact that they couldn't keep the ball out the back of the net. So they pushed out the boat to sign Janssen. Again, I've said this before, I was kind of a little bit dubious about that, because he can be really kind of, when the pressure's on, he certainly was with Leeds, he can be slightly reckless, but he seems to be an outstanding signing for them, offered leadership in a really young team. And look, you know all this yourself, so I think it's the balance. It's the balance of the team this year that is the difference.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I remember having a conversation with Thomas Frank at the LMA end of season dinner, where perhaps a little bit of alcohol had been consumed. So he was a little bit more free flowing with the conversation, let's say. But he had said, and we discussed the season that had just finished and what was going to happen with the season coming up and where they needed to strengthen. And it was that we needed a leader. We needed someone with experience who could also help to the game management side of things. We just didn't have that in our side. And I think Pontus Janssen has brought that to the team, certainly so. And we mentioned Thomas Frank. He was named the Brentford head coach in October 2018, having worked as Dean Smith's assistant, who departed for Aston Villa. His only previous coaching experience was in his native Denmark with Bromby and in the junior setup of the national team, with many surprised at him being preferred to a more experienced coach. Having said that, I wasn't surprised. I was an advocate of Thomas Frank, because for me, I remember thinking he knows our setup already. He knows how we like to play. He knows what we want to do, how we want to achieve things. And it made common sense to me that you just go with someone like Thomas Frank. It was a bit like when Uwe Rosler left and Mark Warburton took over. That's how I saw it. But James, let me come to you. What have you made of Thomas Frank?
I thought on the face of it, it was quite a risky appointment while understanding the structure that Brentford have. Yeah. What might stand them in good stead next season is the fact that this is a process that has gradually built and built and built. And you were talking there, Gregor, about the defence and how, if we looked at, say, how Liverpool have improved over the last three seasons, it was they sorted the front three, and then they sorted Van Dijk, and then they sorted a goalkeeper. And there was a clear train of thought throughout, and there was a clear strategy. And I could see Brentford, this could be a ridiculous prediction, but I could quite conceivably see them doing something similar to what Sheffield United have done.
In that you have
okay, with Chris Wilder, he'd take them through the divisions, but Frank's been part of a process that has kept true to its ethos and true to its philosophy, and everyone buying into that. They're solid at the back, they're electric up front. I think they might need a bit of Premier League nous added in there in whenever the summer is. In terms of the transfer window, but I can see this is the benefit of having a long-term structure and plan.
Mm. Gregor, I mean, I don't really want to be talking about this. I feel like I'm jinxing everything. But is James having a laugh, or should I be looking forward to some major highlights next season?
I think you need to get over the line first. It's the same, you know. We're not mentioning Leeds on this podcast because their time will come. But they're, you know, the hype is building up so much, and they've not done it yet. So, you know, I don't think you should get too carried away. But no, I do actually understand where James has come from there. I mean, as it's been said before, they have this model, and they'll stick to it, and you know, they'll just raise the kind of the standards and the parameters of, you know, the price that they're willing to pay and stuff, but they'll still be looking for value where other people don't. And Frank's done a brilliant job, and I'm happy to say I was wrong about that. I remember visiting when, you know, it was just after Rob Rowan tragically passed away as well, who was the he was like the kind of director of football, and you know the club was really rocked at that time, and Frank was on had just been appointed, and they were on a bad losing run, and I just felt that it could be difficult for him to kind of haul it back from that point. The club was in a really difficult place, but in fairness, he did, and he's very engaging as well. You know, you've met him, and it sounds like he's someone who, you know, although he's not come from a traditional background in terms of a former player, he's been coaching since the late 90s. He's a psychology graduate. He's a former PE teacher, so he kind of, you know, he spent his whole life trying to get across a message, and he's obviously very, very good at what he does. So, yeah, I mean, it's just, as I say, it's the kind of, whenever there's a question mark about what Brentford do, give them a little bit of time and they answer it.
So that's the top end of the table. Let's focus at the bottom end of the Championship. And one result stands out from this week, without a doubt. Wigan 8, Hull 0, equaling the biggest victory in Championship history, with Wigan scoring 7 in the first half. In an extraordinary first 45 minutes at the DW Stadium, Cal Naismith, Jamal Lowe and Joe Williams all got on the score sheet for the hosts, with Kiefer Moore and Kieran Dowell netting twice. Dowell then completed his hat-trick after the break, but that was where the scoring ended, as Wigan also kept a 10th clean sheet in 11 games, with Wigan only having 9 shots on target, despite scoring those 8 goals. It was quite a humdinger of a result. Could anyone have foreseen that, Gregor?
I certainly don't think so, no. It's one of those where you watch the highlights, you watch the goals, and first thing that sort of struck you was everything that Wigan hit went in. It was just, you know, at the start it was like, this is kind of, you know, they can't miss, and then you just saw the confidence drain away from Hull's players, and it looked like they were doing that kind of thing where they pretend to close down, they pretend to try and make a block. They're just going through the motions to do what they can to cover their own backs, and it was nowhere near good enough. And the way they crumbled would be hugely alarming. So it was an amazing result. And but as I say, some of the goals, I mean, Kieran Dowell's volley in the second half was like a one-off. The ball was fizzed in at him, and he kind of threw his leg out at it, and it looped over the goalie and into the top corner. So, you know, everything that they hit turned to gold. But Wigan, I mean, considering the what's been happening at Wigan, it's a remarkable result and a remarkable show of kind of togetherness and spirit and bravery.
Inevitably, Gregor, I have to ask you the question, have you ever experienced anything like that before, being 7-0 down at half time?
No, I'm afraid not. I mean, I was having a little think about this, and I think the worst I've never conceded more than 5 in a game, which wasn't good, don't get me wrong. One was against Brentford, your lot, actually, when I was at Crewe. We lost 5-1. I think it was 3-0 at half time. And I lost 5-0 to Swindon once. Ryan Mason, who went off to play, well, he was on loan from Spurs. He scored a hat trick. And I was a game 3-0 down at Newport County once, and I was dragged off at half time. That was a major low point in my career, and especially as we nearly came back to 3-3, it was 3-2 in the end, so it was obviously a good move from Chris Wilder, that one.
See, he knows what he's talking about. What was his reason for dragging you off, though, exactly?
I just wasn't having a good time, basically. Oh. Myself and the right back, he took us both off. I think he went to 3 at the back and sort of threw on a midfielder and someone else at the back, and it was a change of shape sort of thing. So that was kind of one consolation, but still, it's never good. It's one of the worst things that can happen to you as a footballer, getting the drag at halftime.
So was that the birth of Chris Wilder and Sheffield United's 3 at the back? Was that the moment it all changed?
Who knows? I mean,
in years to come, we'll talk about doing the Gregor. I mean, it'd be brilliant. 3 at the back, overlapping centre-halves. It'd be brilliant.
Well, doing the not Gregor.
Yeah, maybe.
Doing without Gregor.
but, James, I mean, obviously, as fans of the game, having never played the professional game, have you ever witnessed anything like what we saw with Wigan and Hull?
I've not witnessed anything as bad as that in terms of the scoreline being 7. But when I was a student, my best friend Matt he lives in Wickham, and we decided to get the bus from Oxford to Wickham to go and watch Orient play at Adams Park on a Tuesday night. And bizarrely, Orient fielded 7 goalkeepers in that season. I think it was 2012. It was just a real bad luck with injuries. We fielded 7 different goalkeepers, including on this night, Paul Wachubka, who I think was signed on loan from Leeds, basically on the bus on the way to the game because we didn't have any other goalkeepers. And we were 4-0 down at half time, and including one which sort of really did slip through his fingers, and it was quite awful to watch. And we did contemplate leaving at half time, but we stayed on, and it was 4-2 in the end. So it was won the second half, as they sort of cliched. But no, it was particularly bad, and it was interesting because, you know, as I'm sure we'll get onto, a lot of the Wickham players, well, Matt Bloomfield was playing that day, and I think he might have scored, and obviously he's been part of their recent success.
Mm. Yeah, I'm trying to think of a Brentford game that I might have seen that was as depressing, let's say, as the Hull fans would have gone through. Because we have been talking so glowingly about Brentford, we should talk about some negative aspects. And there was one game, actually, and I'm going back to, 2007. I think Terry Butcher was our manager. We did lose 7-0, and that was to Peterborough, but we were actually 4-0 down at half-time, and our goalkeeper had been sent off in the second minute. So you know when your goalkeeper is sent off that early on, you just know it's not going to go your way. So, yeah, not great. I think Aaron McLean scored a hat-trick, and George Boyd, Craig McHale-Smith, names very familiar to Peterborough fans, all were on the score sheet. So yeah, not great at all. But Gregor, 7-0 down in 45 minutes is some thrashing, but 6 of those goals I think were scored in something like 18 minutes. It's just incomprehensible that Hull could have gone in at half time to be 7-0 down. But how on earth can you ever pick yourself up from something like that?
Well, I mean, this is the thing. It's historic, really. It's kind of That level of capitulation, and you know, I was watching the goals, and thinking, having fans there, I don't know how that would have affected it. I mean, the atmosphere would have been toxic if you'd even gone, you know, 2 or 3 goals down in that kind of short space of time. I couldn't imagine what it would have been like if there were supporters there. But I also wonder whether having supporters there to kind of rouse the players a little bit from what was clearly a massive slumber, whether that might have had some kind of effect. I also was finding it quite funny that all you could hear was Paul Cook's voice bellowing on from the sidelines. And, you know, normally you see him coming in a kind of post-match interview afterwards, and he's hoarse, he's lost his voice. I've wondered whether he wouldn't have to be kind of calmed down a little bit on the touchlines, but obviously not. Wigan were outstanding, but Hull just defensively, as I say, it looked like they were going through the motions, and yeah, hugely worrying.
Keeping on Wigan, I remember a few years ago when they were in the Premier League and they lost 9-1 at Spurs.
Yes.
And Tom Roddy did a piece in the Times when Southampton lost 9-0, and he spoke to Chris Kirkland about how do you bounce back as a player as a goalkeeper from conceding 9 goals in a match. And the following week they kept a clean sheet and beat Sunderland 1-0. So you can just have these off days that you all gel and click the following week.
We've talked a lot about Hull and this, and we'll talk more about them in just a moment, Gregor. But when you know with what's happening at Wigan with that administration that came out of nowhere, the redundancies that have been taking place, the uncertainty that is going on as well. When they put in a performance like they did, is that something that can galvanise a squad?
Yeah, I mean, we touched on this when the news broke. It is something that it creates a siege mentality. It's like, you know, it really is us against the world, us against the owners of the football club, us against every team we face, against just the people within that dressing room. It brings everyone together, and it's kind of undoubtedly it will have spurred them on. But the one thing you have to say is they didn't really need spurred on in the first place. They were in a remarkable run of form. I think since the turn of the year, certainly a couple of weeks ago, they were only only Derby County who'd won more points, and Derby have fallen away a bit. So there won't be many teams who've won as many points since the turn of the year, and they were bottom of the league. And now they're mid-table, 12 points from safety, which could be absolutely crucial. So, listen, I think Paul Cook deserves enormous credit, and all the worry and all the kind of uncertainty off the field, the fact that they're not being paid their full salaries, they're looking at selling some young players, even Paul Cook is being linked with other clubs now. You know, all of these things, they've just got to get through these last two games and secure their championship status. And I think Wigan is a club that there's been a lot of interest in, and, you know, hopefully everything can get resolved after that. And the real kind of tragedy would be if they were relegated after such a remarkable run of form in 2020.
Yeah.
It's interesting you mentioned the galvanising impact, though, because I remember when Chris Wilder was at Northampton, and the year they won League Two, yeah. They were facing winding up petitions, players weren't being paid, there was a stand that was just a skeleton on the far side of the stadium because there'd been some issue with the funding of that stand, and they were already in brilliant form and at the top of League Two and running away with it. And all it did was just continue to give them a siege mentality, as you say, Gregor. And they went on to romp to that title. And I do think it isn't, you don't see it in every single case, but particularly when the form is good already, I think there is a real sense of there's too much riding on it to give it up. And some of the efforts that, you know, in the community that have been taking place, such as, I think I was reading, there's a 6-year-old lad had a garage sale and has raised 500 quid, you know. So it's brilliant. I really do hope that all their efforts are rewarded with staying in the championship.
Yeah, I think I would echo that as well. But we should talk about Hull then. Their woeful run of form in 2020 continues. Grant McCann's side have won just once in their past 18 games, losing 14 of them. If you go back to New Year's Day, they were eighth, 4 points off third place. Since then, they've taken 6 points from a possible 54 and are now 2 points from safety with two to play with an inferior goal difference of minus 26. Now, we know they sold Jared Bowen to West Ham and Kamil Grzycki to West Brom in January. Gregor, can this slump in form be simply put down to those transfers?
Well, it is huge. I mean, Jared Bowen, I think he'd scored 16 goals. Grzycki had scored 7. And next on the list is Tom Eves with 5. So, you know, absolutely. Also, if they weren't scoring the goals, they were creating them. So it not only took away the threat, also took away the creativity as well. But look, as well as that, there's been a category of issues. The captain, Eric Lehigh, and the vice-captain, Jackson Irvin, have left. They failed to agree the terms to play this month. And reportedly, they were basically asked to play for free. Three years ago, they were in the Premier League and they were getting crowds of 25,000 fans, and this season, even, you know, before lockdown, there was a couple of times where they dipped below 10,000. So it's a very sad story of decline there, because the Alums, the owners of the club, saved the club, took it to the Premier League twice, they built the new stadium, they reached the Cup final, FA Cup final. But, you know, it's just completely unravelled. They tried to change the name of the club to Hull Tigers. They introduced crazy ticketing scheme, which basically did away with any concessions, which just angered the supporters even more. And the relationship has become toxic. So, you know, they've been trying to sell the club for a long time. I think they've been turning huge profits because they've still been getting parachute payments, and they're paying players some of the lowest salaries in the division. It seems like they're trying to recoup any investment they've made in the club and trying to sell it at the same time. So they thought they could do that as well as selling Bowen and Grzycki in January and keep the club in the championship. And it looks like it may have backfired massively.
Yeah. They face fellow strugglers Luton and then playoff chasing Cardiff in their final two games. I mean, when you look at those fixtures, you're already worrying about them. There was little from this Wigan performance to inspire confidence in their survival. James, do you think Hull are doomed?
Yes, I do. I think the one thing that really stuck out from that performance was there really was a complete lack of leadership. There was no one. I was hearing people who were at the game saying that just couldn't hear anything from the players. You know, there was nobody trying to rally them and nobody trying to kind of inspire any kind of fight back. And I think that's damning, really. I just think the level of that performance tells you a lot about where they are as a club. And I think when there are so many teams around them that are scrapping and fighting, if you're going to show no fight, you're going down.
Mm. Well, the team, of course, who are directly above Hull are Charlton, who are another side on the slide then with no win in five, and they conceded in stoppage time for the seventh occasion this season in a draw at Birmingham City. They host Wigan on Saturday. Gregor, I know we've spoken about this before with the Lyle Taylor and other players at the club who, similarly to what you just mentioned at Hull, didn't want to sign a new contract to see through this end of the season. Do you think they've been affected by missing someone like Taylor, who was so pivotal to them, and also the fact that there has been ongoing issues behind the scenes of ownership and Lee Bowyer's now been linked with the vacant Birmingham job? Do all these factors come into play?
Well, I think they do, but I think, you know, not to the same extent. I think that Lee Bowyer deserves a huge amount of credit for the way that, you know, for getting them into the Championship in the first place a year ago, for the start they had and for being with a chance with the budget they have of survival even at this stage. And then, as you say, losing Lyle Taylor, the biggest thing about that is his goals. And I think, you know, I think they only won something like two games in which he didn't play, and he's been injured quite a lot this season. So losing him was a massive blow. But they've coped pretty admirably. They've had a lot of draws. And this game is enormous. I'm going to this game actually on Saturday. Because Wigan play Fulham in their last game. And Charlton, really, I think Charlton need to win this because obviously Luton and Hull below them, 2 points behind them. If one of them win, then they're into the drop zone. But the one other thing we do have to quickly raise is the fact that in the Championship, nothing is as simple as it seems, because Sheffield Wednesday, Derby, have EFL issues, possibly points deductions in store because of financial fair play issues. Wigan, obviously, we're still not entirely sure if they are more than 12 points from safety, then the points deduction will happen this season. If not, then it'll happen. Sorry, I'll say that again. If Wigan are more than 12 points above the drop zone, then the points deduction will happen this season. If not, then next season they'll begin League One on minus 12. So, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty about other clubs who are higher up in the table and how, you know, off-field issues might eventually affect the final standings. So nothing is certain, and it's certainly going to be an interesting final week.
Oh, it's never straightforward in the Championship, is it? So let's do this then. We'll have to predict the three to go down. James, could you pick your three that you see will be playing in League One?
Well, I think Barnsley are gone. I think Hull are down. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if Huddersfield potentially slipped in there, actually. Ooh. Which would be amazing in a bad way, given the where they were in the, you know, recently in the Premier League. I think Lee Bowyer has done an excellent job at Charlton. Whether they'll have enough to get over the line, I don't know. But Luton have had some good results, and I could just see them sneaking out.
So you're going for Huddersfield, Hull, and Barnsley. Gregor, is that a similar three to you?
I mean, this is even harder than the Premier League kind of top four predictions last week. I think Charlton, this is enormous. Wigan, they play Wigan, and then they've got Leeds on the last day. Obviously, Leeds could be up by then. So, you know, there's so many different permutations about this. I'd really sad to say it, but I think Charlton could be in trouble. I think Wigan are on an amazing run, and I think Charlton might slip in. So I think it could be Barnes. I think Luton will beat Hull, which will lift them out. So that would mean Barnsley, Hull, and Charlton.
Goodness me, goodness me. Just a line though. Interesting what you mentioned about Huddersfield, James, because as you say, just last season they were playing in the Premier League. Admittedly, not a great season. But the previous season, that was their second season in the Premier League. So how on earth have they got to this stage where they are fighting relegation? I know, obviously, sometimes it's not easy to bounce straight back. But you'd have thought perhaps they'd at least be mid-table. How on earth do you think they could be in a relegation battle?
I think there is a slight concern over... Their points tally last season was so bad that their form was so bad and that can carry into another season. You know, they weren't in any good shape really. And I think they're very much like a number of teams that come down from the Premier League. The parachute payments are huge, and I think the worry for them is that when that money runs out, where's the investment going to come from? And I don't think their recruitment's been great. And I think it's the same with, you know, Stoke have struggled this season as well, having been a recent Premier League team. Middlesbrough have struggled this season, having been a recent Premier League team. This can very easily happen to those bigger clubs.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host Luke Jones for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
One team that will definitely be playing Championship football next season are Wycombe Wanderers. They edged past Oxford United in the League One playoff final at Wembley 2-1, thanks to a late Joe Jacobson penalty to send them into the second tier of English football for the first time in their history. Having nearly dropped out of the Football League just 6 years ago, they were tipped for relegation this time around after a bottom six finish last time they were out. Added to that, when the regular season was suspended in March because of the coronavirus pandemic, Wycombe were outside the playoff places in the third tier. But when the final league standings were determined on an unweighted points per game basis, Gareth Ainsworth's side leapt up to third to book their shot at promotion. Gregor, we mentioned at the top of the pod that you were at this League One playoff final, but looking at Wycombe as a whole, how on earth have they pulled this off?
Amazing story. I think the first thing is to address that the fact that they leapt into they leapt from eighth to third, and there's a lot of clubs even now, even despite their kind of the fairy tale ascent, are still quite upset about that. But in fairness to them, the game that they missed was scheduled to be Bury, and Bury no longer exists. So there's very complicated, and they definitely deserved. I think they were top of the league more than any other club, or in the top two more than any other club throughout the season. So how have they done it? Last summer they began the season with nine players. Nine players turned up to day one of pre-season. And they were a supporter-owned football club since 2012, I think. They were doing very well to survive in League One. I think they finished 17th last season. And They got some investment. Well, it was a very interesting deal as well. There was an investor called Rob Kuhig from America. He offered to, it was like a try before you buy a deal. So he offered to loan the club money. They would, the Supporters Trust would maintain a 25% stake in the club. They would keep the title deeds to Adams Park, and they would see how they worked together. And, you know, it felt like a dream offer for the Supporters Trust. And it was only in February, actually, that the deal was finally sealed. So he gave them, they really were struggling financially, and he gave them a bit of money. And we're not talking a lot of money. We're talking still a budget of less than $2.5 million, which would fall under any wage cap that comes in and would put them like near the bottom, certainly in the bottom half of League One in budget terms. So, but that gave Ainsworth the ability to sign some more players, and they started off like a house on fire, and it's remarkable. It's been down to Ainsworth. Ainsworth is a huge character. He's the longest serving manager in the Football League. He's been there 8 years, I think. Mm. In 2014, he kept them up on the final day of the season in League Two, so they had to go to Torquay United, and they won 3-0 to keep them in the Football League. They don't have a youth team. They don't have a reserve team. There's been times where he's had to kind of order a bag of balls on eBay because the club had no money to support him, basically. And it's just a remarkable thing. It's something that is, when you speak to any player, he's built a culture in the football club that everyone enjoys going into work. They play a certain style of football, again, that doesn't make them that popular to some people in terms of they're quite direct. But they've got some great characters. And if ever, as I said at the start, if ever there's been a promotion that has been built on sort of togetherness, team spirit, and that kind of attitude, the desire, then this is it.
Well, the final was a clash of styles with Oxford, ranked first for possession and passing in League One, and Wickham, as you sort of alluded to there, Gregor, by contrast, ranked bottom. When you hear that, James, how much do you think they'll have to change that direct style to succeed in the Championship? Or can that still be successful, being so direct?
I think it can. I think that I'd be very surprised if Wickham aren't battling against relegation next season, just because of the size of the club and the squad at Ainsworth's disposal at the moment. It's a remarkable achievement going up, but I think they should stick to the style that's got them promoted, because I remember when Colchester United got into the Championship probably about 10 years ago now, but they made themselves a really awkward team, and I think that was the year Roy Keane's Sunderland got promoted to the Premier League, and I think one of the only games they lost was Colchester away, because they just made Laya Road a really difficult place to come, and I think that will be key. I think it'll be having a sort of siege mentality at home, and if the home form's good, then they've definitely got a fighting chance. It's obviously going to be, I don't want to sound negative at all, because it's one of the best sorts of the season. But I mean, you look at teams like Burton, who've gone up and stayed up. Yeovil had a season there. It's very difficult if you're a smaller club who's never been in the second tier. But I think they've got the best of chances to do it, and it'll be a really enjoyable ride. I really hope for the Wickham fans that some will be in a position as a country for fans to be able to get back in the grounds, because I think it would be, you know, those fans deserve the opportunity to see their team in the Championship. And I think that's what I remember going to Yeovil's first game in the Championship. I think it was a Millwall, and they travelled amazingly, had a huge following behind the goal. That's what you live for as a lower league football fan. It almost doesn't matter if you don't stay up that season, because you want the chance to see your team test themselves against recent former Premier League teams and give it a go. And also, you could always dream, and you always want your, you know, you think, you know, God, we're actually only one division away from the Premier League. So I just hope, really, really hope that we'll be in a place to have some fans in stadiums next year.
Absolutely. Well, Wickham only became a Football League club in 1993 when Martin O'Neill led them out of non-league. It's a remarkable story that's now been led front and centre by the inspirational Gareth Ainsworth. Or should we call him Wild Thing, as the 47-year-old is affectionately known? He moonlights as the lead singer of the Cold-Blooded Hearts and had to cancel band practice to lead his team out at Wembley, where he prowled the touchline in skinny jeans and a pair of red leather cowboy boots. That must have been some sight, Gregor.
Yes, yes. And he's always got his kind of his shirt undone to the navel.
Yes.
His long flowing locks. He drives a Mustang. So, yeah, he's a, certainly he's a rocker. He's a rocker, yeah. I was speaking to Joe Jacobson, who scored the winning penalty and set up the first goal as well. I was speaking to him earlier on today, actually, and he says that win, lose or draw, every Monday, you turn up at 9 o'clock in the morning and you go into the gym, and Ainsworth has got his rock music blaring out. He's whooping and high-fiving everyone when they walk in, and he's like, how can we not want to play for this guy? So it really is a kind of a tale of a manager inspiring a group of players, and a lot of players who really, they might not still be playing today if it wasn't for him. Players like Matt Bloomfield, who's 36, mm-hmm. and he's played for them for, this is his 17th season, I believe. Darius Charles, guy who's 32, he was told to retire last summer because he's got an arthritic hip. And Ainsworth just said, you tailor your training. And he tried and tried and tried. And he's played 25 games, I think, this season, played at Wembley. Joe Jacobson, 33. He played one game for Cardiff when he was 19. And he's been trying to get back to the Championship ever since. And these guys are kind of like his leaders in the dressing room. So, and obviously the man we're going to come on to is Akin Fenwa.
Yeah, we'll talk about him in just a moment. But when you think about the open shirt, the skinny jeans, the leather cowboy boots, bright red as well. James, can you think of another manager who could pull off such a look on the touchline?
Paul Tisdale's always been quite sharp, hasn't he?
Oh, yes.
I always used to like, I always loved his style. I remember covering a game at Exeter once, and he just won 4-0, and he leans over the he's got the press sort of huddled round by the dugout, and he leans over the wall, and this fan gives him an empty ice cream tub, and he goes, "Oh, here's my breakfast for the morning," and it was a lady in the crowd who kept hens and had brought some eggs. Some freshly laid eggs to the match and gave them to Paul Tisdale. And it was just like, it was like, not only are you one of the sharpest dressed managers, but you've also got your breakfast lined up in the crowd. I mean, it was incredible. In terms of, I mean, I thought Matt Dickinson did a piece with Martin O'Neill, watched the game with Martin O'Neill. And we ran in the paper, the two pictures side by side of O'Neill with the conference trophy and Ainsworth, and I think you've got a great sort of contrast of like 90s tracksuited manager. You couldn't get a bigger contrast of the two. I mean, Gregor, who was sort of sartorially best and worst managers you played for?
Oh goodness me, they were all terrible. he's certainly an outlier, Ainsworth. There's not many. The answer to your question is there is not many managers who can pull off red snakeskin cowboy boots or skinny jeans on the touchline.
Do you know who I think could? And I don't know why, but I think someone like Paolo Di Canio could. He just has that sort of, you know, there's something about Paolo. He could just get away with anything, couldn't he? Really, I imagine. But surely, come on, Gregor.
Pep's quite sharp, isn't he? I mean, like Pep yes. also has, Pep's, with his jumpers. But no, Gregor, you've got to name someone.
Who was good or bad? Let me think. I mean, seriously, you're going back to people like Joe Kinnear and Gary Megson. They certainly didn't see much but a baggy tracksuit or a baggy suit from them. Honestly, there is no one. There is no one who's been a good dresser. They all wear a baggy tracksuit or a baggy suit and get the mickey taken out of them when they turn their back in the changing room.
Well, do you know what, Gregor, you mentioned one of those players that we need to talk about in more detail. On 62 minutes at Wembley and with the score at 1-1, Ainsworth threw on wildcard frontman Adebayo Akinfenwa. It had the desired effect, which means the 38-year-old should get his chance to play championship football with Wickham against the likes of Norwich and Sheffield Wednesday. And Akinfenwa hit the headlines again post-match, with the boyhood Liverpool fan telling TV cameras, "Let me tell you something. The only person that can hit me up on WhatsApp this time is Klopp, so we can celebrate together. You get me? Oi." I think I sounded really like Bayer Akinfenwa.
That was good. That was really good.
Thank you. But and sure enough, what happened? The Liverpool boss did call Akinfenwa, congratulating him via video call, we should say, with the frontman unable to sleep that night, still awake at 9 a.m. the next morning. Obviously, any kind of playoff final victory is a stuff of fairy tales. But Gregor, I'll come to you about Akinfenwa. How good was that reaction from him?
It was brilliant. It's one of the most kind of genuine, but humorous and kind of memorable interviews I can remember, to be honest, because he was just so happy. He's 38. He's a lower league legend. He's one of the biggest characters in kind of lower league English football, and he's never played in the championship. And he's reached his kind of what for him was the goal, the kind of pinnacle, at the age of 38. It's an amazing story. And when I was speaking to Joe Jacobson today, he told me an interesting thing that before the game, they had a video meeting in the hotel, Wickham did, and basically Akinfenwa had arranged all these messages. So they turn on the screen and there's Virgil van Dijk, John Terry, Jamie Redknapp, mm-hmm. Sol Campbell, Anthony Joshua, Jack Grealish, Sol Campbell, Patrice Evra, all of these guys were sending good luck message to Wickham. So, you know, he's got a bit of, he carries a bit of weight in sort of two ways. Akinfenwa, he does a bit of work for Sky and stuff, and he's kind of quite a big, well-known guy. And he obviously pulled some strings to get a bit of a motivational boost for the lads before the game as well, which I thought was a nice story.
Sounds like he's cheating, getting all these people to help out. That's not on. No, I mean, it is great, you have to say. And is this, James, what makes the EFL so great? Because we get these personal stories and we get this reaction that's so raw, that is so wonderful to see. It matters so much to Akinfenwa, as it did to all those Wickham players. Is that something that makes the EFL sort of different? Does it set it apart from the Premier League?
Yeah, I think there is more. There's certainly more access at that level, and I think there is more of a connection with the fans and the players. I mean, I remember being really jealous as a kid. A really good friend of mine is a Swansea fan, and this is like before they had their Premier League days, back when they were kind of Lee Trundle and players like that. And I just remember he used to always do. There was always a bowling event, a Tempin bowling with the Swansea squad, that he used to do every year. And I used to be like, wow, you're meeting all these players who you consider a legend. I think he might have gone bowling with Akinfenwa when he was there. But it's that kind of thing. It's the chance to meet. You can meet your heroes sort of really quite easily. I remember the year Orient got promoted, and they did a big kind of celebration event at the club that we went to, and you got to meet all the players. It was incredible. And as a sort of wide-eyed 14-year-old, I was like, oh my God, these are all my heroes, all here, you know. So I think that it is a huge part of what makes the EFL, particularly when you get down to sort of League One and League Two, what makes it, it sets it apart.
Yeah. Well, Akinfenwa has gained somewhat of a cult following for being the strongest player in the FIFA video game, possessing a physique that wouldn't look out of place in the NFL. He is known as the Beast. He stands at 5'11" and weighs a whopping 120 kilograms. But guess what? He can actually bench more than that, a full 180 kilograms. During his career, he has scored 132 goals in 393 matches, but has never stayed at one club for longer than 30 months, having spells in England, Wales and Lithuania. Gregor, why does he gain cult status, do you think, at every club he goes to?
It's because he's a huge personality. You saw that in the video and in the interview. Any club he's at, he is kind of... he's just a huge presence in the dressing room, on the pitch, in every aspect of the of that football club. So there are some clubs that are kind of, and managers perhaps, who would be put off by that, and they wouldn't be certainly they would be happy or confident dealing with him. But Gareth Ainsworth has embraced that, and he's seen that, you know, it's not all the kind of larger than life personality with him as well. He actually does, you know, he's serious in the changing room, and you saw him after the victories against Fleetwood in the first leg particularly. He gathers all the players, he got them in a huddle, and he's standing in the middle and he's making points about, you know, this is what's going to happen, this, you know, you need to prepare right for the next game, and, you know, he's a leader as well. So I think Gareth Ainsworth saw that, and as Bayo said in the interview 4 years ago, he was standing in the same place with AFC Wimbledon, having just won promotion to League One, and he's technically unemployed. You know, that would have been him 34. You know, he's someone who, he's had injuries, he's a big guy, his body's taken a bit of a pounding, I would imagine. You know, he could quite easily have called it a day at that point, and probably there weren't too many people who were willing to give him another chance, but Ainsworth has, and every year in the last 4 years he's been top goalscorer for them, and they're in the Championship. Brilliant.
It is brilliant. I also think as well,
go on, James.
I think as well there's as you say, Gregor, there's a serious side to this as well. He's had to work so hard to get his break in the game as well. I mean, I remember his early years playing for a whole host of third division clubs. And then he had a spell in Lithuania as a youngster where he suffered appalling racist abuse. He's an example of, there are so many examples of this in the Football League of players who really work so hard to get that opportunity, and then the moment they get that opportunity, they make the absolute most of it. And you could just tell how much he loves football by the fact that he's still going at this age, and he's still the life and soul of the club that he goes to. As much as for the Wickham fans, I want back in the stadium for next season. I want them there for him as well, because I want him to really be able to enjoy his season in the Championship, hopefully more seasons in the Championship. But I really hope he gets to enjoy this moment fully.
Well, that is it for now. Many thanks to Gregor and to James. Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It's just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information. We will be back with you on Monday, where the promotion and relegation picture in the Championship may be a lot clearer.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.